until the 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th. Concordia Seminary Lyceum presents A Week of Impact in Systematic Theology. This tape is by Professor Carl E. Broughton of the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. It is the first in a series of two lectures on new methods in systematic theology.
Gentlemen, I never would have written those words that I thought they would ever be used against me. And that's the trouble with writing letters. Before I begin to present to you what I've prepared, I want to tell you roughly what I'm going to try to do tonight and tomorrow night. The overall title could be The Horizon of the Future as the reigning principle in systematic theology. First of all, then, I have 4 points. I'm going to deal with 2 of them tonight, 2 tomorrow night. My first point is going to argue that we need to begin again in theology, and the place to begin is at the end. Eschatology is the beginning of theology. My second point is that we must break ourselves free from certain alliances between theology and some fashionable types of philosophy. So my second point is beyond existentialism, language analysis philosophy. My third point calls for a new correlation between theology and the horizon of our contemporary culture, the correlation with the futuristic thrust in modern culture, the correlation with the philosophy of hope, in correlation with secular futurology. My fourth point will deal with the wave or the challenge or the task of systematic theology as a hermeneutic, a method whereby we do as Wolfhard Pannenberg has said, we use the horizon of primitive Christianity with the horizon of modern culture in a new comprehensive horizon, which is the horizon of the future. And therefore, my overall theme, the horizon of the future as a reigning principle in systematic theology. In the long run, it may become evident that radical theology has been having a cathartic effect on the church and its theology. The death of God's saves may have helped to force theology to find a new beginning. I am a partisan in this quest for a new way to start theology. Therefore, while I am unable to count myself, and I think there would be few others who would wish to number me among the radical theologians, I feel myself closer to them than I have yet dared to acknowledge. Their questions are always in my mind. Their answers are always challenging those I have been taught to prefer. I share with them some of the shock at witnessing the collapse of the going system. Whether one cuts his theological eyepiece more on Barth, Bultmann, or Tillich, or someone else, the feeling is quite general that we can hardly go on the way we have been going. But how do we begin again? Where do we go from here? My own gamble, then, is to work in alliance with a new movement in modern theology, which tries to grasp the gravity of the issues which confront the church and its theology today. The new place to start in theology is at the end, eschatology. The rediscovery of the role of eschatology in the preaching of Jesus and of early Christianity has been one of the most important events of recent theological history. writings of biblical theologians, however, have not always, perhaps only rarely, been taken seriously by systematic theologians. In spite of their paying lip service to Sola Scriptura, the main response of systematic theology to the rediscovery of eschatology has been to so redefine the eschatology in question that it has lost its futurity. Eschatology has been predominantly understood as the dimension of the eternal shining through the temporal in rather Platonic fashion. And so it is true what someone has said, that very soon in Christianity became a kind of Platonism for the masses. Now, this Platonizing of eschatology is not only true of the continentals, who have operated under some version of dialectical or existentialist theology, but also of the Anglo-Saxons, who, following C.H. Dodd or someone similar, have accepted some form of a realized eschatology. Both in exegetical and systematic circles, the dimension of the future in biblical eschatology has been a source of embarrassment. This horror of the future is perhaps best understood as a sign of the degree to which modern theology, as a function of the church, has succumbed to the establishmentarian mentality that has crippled the Christian movement in modern times, the extent to which theology has become ideology, and thereby set it in opposition to the revolutionary forces at work to change the world. Revolutionary thinking is always oriented to the future. It does not accept the past or the status quo as the picture of the homeland and the happy days which all men seek in one way or other. It has been good form for futureless Christians to deride utopianism in the past generation. Little did they realize, or perhaps they did, that in chucking utopianism altogether, they lost their own eschatology, which looks to the future of God's final and fulfilling coming. It is this loss of eschatology which has precipitated that mood in theology which feels it has lost God. Hopelessness is godlessness because both are futurelessness. Hope is a word whose parlous is the future. As a questioning being, man is oriented in hope towards the future. The categories of hope and future are crucial in the new theology which begins with eschatology. For this reason, it is variously referred to as a theology of hope. I prefer to call it a theology of the future. Sometimes it is also referred to as a theology of promise. I prefer to call it a theology for revolution. What one cares to call it matters very little, except that every new movement finds its own slogan, its own alluring rhetoric. A theology that addresses the whole man should not be faulted for using rhetoric, provided that that does not blur the rationality of its vision. Especially when one's vision orients to the future, there is admittedly a need for reason, ratio to apply the brakes, and to give a careful account of the logic of the language of hope that prospects the future. We do not claim to be able to offer more than a little sigh towards such an account. Hope was the original impulse of theology, says Ernst Benz. Jürgen Moltmann states, there is therefore only one real problem in Christian theology, which its own object forces upon it, and which it in turn forces on mankind and on human thought, the problem of the future. Gerhard Sauter wrote his massive Habilitation Schrift on the theme of the future, Zukunft und Verheißung in contemporary theology and philosophy. Harvey Cox, in similar vein, has stated, the only future that theology has is to become the theology of the future. The theology of Wolfhard Pannenberg made the initial breakthrough toward the triumph of the future as a controlling thematic in an eschatological interpretation of universal history, embracing the totality of developing reality. Meanwhile, this futurist approach is making headway among Roman Catholic theologians. For example, the later essays of Karl Rahner, after he began to emerge out of his existentialist phase, Schillebeck, and Johannes Metz. Metz lays down a challenge to Catholic theology the transforming effect of which could carry far beyond anything imagined at Vatican II. Doing theology within the horizon of the future, he says, reveals the world as history, history as final history, faith as hope, and theology as eschatology. Ecumenical and confessional, liturgical and missiological questions will all appear differently, and some will disappear within a framework of historical and eschatological thinking. The idea of doing theology as eschatology is not new. It has a familiar enough ring. From the start, the dialectical theologians, Barth and company, insisted that, and I quote from the Romans commentary, Christianity that is not entirely and altogether eschatology has entirely and altogether nothing to do with Christ. And of course, these dialectical theologians taught that eschatology cannot be confined to the last things which orthodoxy reserves for the concluding chapter of dogmatics. They said, eschatology permeates the whole of Christian faith. It is the dimension of the eternal breaking in from above into the present moment. For the early Bar, as for the later Tillich, the eschatology of the eternal now was dominant. The universal relevance of eschatology was gained, however, by a radical redefinition in which the horizon of the future disappeared into the depth of eternity simmering in the present moment. In the case of Barth, the future was absorbed into the nunc aeterni topic, manifest in the incarnate word. In Bultmann's case, the future was finally subjectivized into the futuricity of existence in the immediate present. The eschatological future became an existential step. The future as the approaching front on which really new things are expected to happen was not the focus of faith during the period in which Barth's theology of the Word of God or Bultmann's charismatic theology of existence were most influential. They did not teach their disciples to love the future. Theology was eschatological, yes, but in terms of the dialectic between time and eternity, from above to below, but at the price of its futurity. The theology of the future today builds on the insight of dialectical theology that eschatology ought not stand at the end of a system of Christian doctrine. Eschatology is not that last stage sort of thing. But a theology of the future today goes beyond dialectical theology in exploring the full scope of the eschatological horizon of hope. Eschatology has been a favorite word in modern theology. But how to activate it without surrendering its future meaning remained an unsolved problem in dialectical and existentialist types of systematic theology. For how can one speak of the future when it has not yet happened? But then, are we really dealing with a primitive Christian method at all if we remain silent about the future of man? This doubt has often been suppressed by assurances and reassurances that all that matters, after all, is a realized eschatology. But can we expect, or can we accept, a wholly realized eschatology in this imperfect world of imperfect men? Is that really more credible to Christians than to Jews, who were promised they could expect more, much more, from the coming of the Messianic Kingdom? Much more than Jesus of Nazareth ever achieved. theologian knows today about Albert Schweitzer's rediscovery of apocalyptic eschatology and the preaching of Jesus? For Schweitzer, it was precisely this eschatology which alienated Jesus from modern culture and kept him riveted to the worldview of the first century. Schweitzer doubted that one could get a contemporary Christ out of an apocalyptic Jesus. So he developed a philosophy of life for himself, totally free of any of that eschatology that motivated Jesus. Schweitzer protested against the unhistorical treatment of the Gospels by many of his contemporaries, who distilled from the Gospels a middle-class ethic for cultured Protestants, leaving behind as of no account the eschatological Christology that underlies it, that underlies the ethic. This unhistorical line is being revived today. And this serves some as their theology. Jesus of Nazareth is then lifted out of the eschatological fog of his time and recommended to our world as the man for others. We have the man for others Christology current in modern theology. Jesus is pictured as the man of faith, the man of freedom, of love, open to others, with an emulable style of existence. It is widely thought, how widely I don't know, but I know it is widely thought, that Christology can build directly on Jesus' way with others, on some ethical substratum laid bare by historical criticism. The apocalyptic eschatology in the preaching of Jesus is then either traced unsuccessfully to later churchly redactions or dismissed unscientifically as of marginal significance in Jesus himself. The impulse to modernize Jesus is still strong. And since modernity is supposedly open to ethics but allergic to apocalyptic, the pictures of Jesus are painted a la mode moderne. Jesus is now an existentialist gripped by the urgency of the moment, an agony about God knows not what. Now a civil rights leader demonstrating for the underdog. The neglect of eschatology leads to arbitrary and superficial treatment of the historical Jesus. And Schweitzer was right after all. Doing theology as eschatology is a proposal then to take seriously the apocalyptic character of the charisma of Jesus and to seek his uniqueness not outside of, but within the horizon of its expectations. The function of Jesus' proclamation of the imminent kingdom of God was not merely to announce the time is of the essence, and you must now decide. It brings with it an understanding of reality as history, of the hope of man, and the future of the world. The decisive event within the horizon of apocalyptic hope, as the New Testament presents it, is the act of God in raising Jesus from the dead. Ernst Käsemann made an important step forward among the Bultmanni when he traced the beginnings of Christian theology precisely to apocalypticism. In his words, apocalypticism was the mother of all Christian theology. Apocalypticism was the mother of all Christian theology. Käsemann called into question the current attempts to deal with history ethically, either in existentialist Bultmannian or hermeneutical Abelinian circles. And so Käsemann turned against his closest allies in theology, Bultmann, Abelin, and Fuchs. This came as a blow to a possible unified front among Bultmann's disciples. But Käsemann himself stopped short of consistency. He resisted, in my opinion, his own better judgment when he pictured Jesus' own preaching as an island surrounded on all sides by apocalypticism. Backward into Judaism and forward into primitive Christianity, Jesus was an exception, Käsemann thinks, to the universal character of the apocalyptic worldview. What else is this but still another attempt to find a privileged sanctuary in history for Jesus, to establish his uniqueness negatively by finding something in him that cannot be explained from within his own historical situation. The historical attempt to find some small kernel of difference between Jesus and his environment are misguided if they imagine that Christology and Christian faith can be based on just such a difference. To locate the uniqueness of Jesus that way can only succeed eventually in lifting him out of history, reversing the movement of the incarnation from God to man. Even, perhaps especially, in view of Nicaea's true God and true man, Christian historians are delivered from the temptation to take from Jesus' humanity, which means his radical historicality, to build up his divinity. It is not only historically implausible, but theologically unnecessary to exempt Jesus from the apocalyptic framework of his epoch, within which his ministry was understood by himself, was enacted in late Judaism, and also interpreted in primitive Christianity. But Caseman was right with respect to the Apostle Paul, that even after his conversion, after he became a Christian, the Apostle Paul was an apocalyptic thinker. So the problem for a systematic theology in close touch with biblical exegesis is not how to get around the apocalypticism in Jesus, but how to start with it and find within its horizon the decisive meaning of Jesus Christ for a contemporary understanding of the Christian faith. Here we can anticipate only the barest minimum of what this might mean. Jesus was a Jew who stood within the traditions of late Jewish eschatology. Jesus was a child of his age, a man of his time. The futuristic thrust was an essential element of it, which Jesus shared. Further, Jesus made the claim that the quality of one's relation to that future, that is the future of God's coming kingdom, is determined by one's relation to himself. But the futurity of this future was not exhausted in his earthly presence. There is no realized eschatology in the sense that the not yet of the future is wholly exhausted in the already of the present encounter with Jesus. The power of the future retained its own reality as future in the preaching of Jesus. Only the future could make clear whether God himself would vindicate what Bultmann calls, aptly I think, the implicit Christology in Jesus' self-understanding. The early church saw in the resurrection of Jesus just such a vindication. The resurrection of Jesus stands within the horizon of apocalypticism. The legitimacy of Jesus' own ministry, his word and his work, was confirmed in its life. So the attempt of some theologians today to mediate an encounter with the historical Jesus or the crucified Christ, first by going around the resurrection and then by pulling out the eschatology, may be apologetically motivated as a way of trimming the Christian sails for our time. But in my view, the result lames the Christian witness and is found by the secular man of today not really worth a bother to disconfirm. I'm saying that it is the secular man precisely who cannot understand and doesn't want to have anything to do, doesn't even want to enter into dialogue with such a Christianity that reduces itself merely to contemporaneity. The loss of confidence in what is historically known to be central in the Christian faith has reached an all-time low in the history of theology. Not seldom do I find a theologian striding forth with the false comfort that the resurrection of Jesus is not at the heart of the Christian faith, but only a secondary interpretation, a product of reflection to advance the cause of Jesus after his death. Then we ask, what does the word God mean under such conditions? What if the Christian definition of God in his unity with Jesus is absolutely bound up with a victory over death in the resurrection? What if it's that we mean when we use the word God? May it not then appear that the death of God saves in theology as an inner theological phenomenon, which we have witnessed, is of a piece, can be understood only as the result of the dehistorization of the resurrection and the defuturization of the eschatological horizon within which it occurs and within which alone it has meaning as an answer to the question of man as a hoping creature. God reveals himself through what he has done. For Christian faith, the knowledge of God is eschatological. God is known as the one who raised Jesus from the dead. If you ask me who God is, I point to that event. He is the one who raised Jesus from the dead. I know no other God. Any other God is an idol for Christian faith. The resurrection is the eschatological event in which the end of the old creation and the beginning of the new creation are joined. On this basis, our language of God is filled with the eschatological vision of resurrection hope. In a literal sense, then, hopelessness is godlessness, because both are futurelessness. Hope is a word whose correlate is the future, I said. The New Testament language of hope is oriented to the eschatological future of God, which comes already as an historical occurrence, though only proleptically, that is, provisionally and preliminarily, not finally, in the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. There is no realized eschatology. Hope, future, God, Jesus, eschatology, resurrection, these are all vocables with interlocking meanings in the interconnectedness of historical reality. To see these interconnections in a way that overbridges the history of revelation in the Bible and the conditions of modern understanding is the goal of a systematic theology that starts with eschatology. My second point, beyond existentialism and positivism, or post-positivistic language analysis philosophy. We are saying, our own position is that the way ahead in theology is to take seriously eschatology as the originating factor and impulse in the Christian faith. Then, to interpret it in modern terms as the fulfillment of the future-oriented structure of human existence and of all historical reality. Many theologies which have been passionately concerned to establish a foothold for Christian faith in modern secular thought have been most oblivious to its passion for the future. Not only has theology thereby been unfaithful to its own eschatological origin, but it has dampened the interest of men who are in earnest about the future of mankind. When Karl Rahner, in a lecture before Marxist philosophers, explained Christianity as the religion of the absolute future, Roger Gaudody, the French Marxist philosopher, said, "Well, if you Christians begin to talk that language, we can understand what you mean."
On October 4th,
1968. Carl E. Brockin presents the second lecture during the week of Impact in Systematic Theology at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri. Lecture number 2 begins about 10 minutes into the lecture. It is part 2 of New Methods in Systematic Theology.
The future is not pictured as a further extension of the present, but as an open field of possibility. And we do not know in advance what the range of possibilities, the limits of the possibilities. And so we let our imaginations run freely without being weighted down by the norms of the past. There is a wide range of choice from among competing goals and objectives. A much more fluid view of the future is implied in the goal-seeking approach is over against the trend extrapolation approach. And a higher view of the efficacy of human imagination and human intervention. Ultimately, underlying this methodological ambiguity is finally the ontological question about the status of the future, that is, the reality of the future. Is the future an extension of the past or of the present? Or are the past and present open-ended, subject to new, unexpectable, creative ingressions from the future? Theological interest in the future intersects with secular futurality at both the levels of theory and practice. Of theory, because our view of the future in relation to past and present does affect our capacities for creative anticipation and action. There is ample evidence, for example, that scientific forecasting is a tool that can fall into unscrupulous hands to cause the future. A prediction of a stock market crash can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I say of practice because the human and social goals which technology should be made to serve are by no means self-evident. The machine is made for man, and not man for the machine. Some forecasts, however, warn of a machine takeover which increasingly narrows the perimeters of human freedom. Roderick Zeidenberg, author of Post-Historic Man, prognosticates a future in which there will be, yes, there will be justice for all, but freedom for none, as our technological milieu is expanded and the principle of organization becomes the dominant factor in sculpturing the future. And he says, like the molecules of a gas or of a crystalline solid, none are free, but all are equal. One molecule, one vote. Does this mean that man has no freedom with respect to the future? There are other prophecies, like the prophecy of Jacques Ellul, a French Reformed lay theologian, and of Marshall McLuhan, a Roman Catholic lay thinker. They see in their crystal ball a future increasingly dictated by the built-in momentum of technology. But they disagree on whether to be pessimistic or optimistic about this technocratized culture. Now, both Jacques Ellul and Marshall McLuhan are future-oriented Christians. Their disagreement cannot be adjudicated by getting more scientific information or gaining new technological skills. For their argument is basically about goals. What image of man and what picture of community guides our planning, fills our hopes for the future, and reacts critically upon false and inhuman schemes? This is a question of necessarily what we ought to allow it to do, not necessarily what it ought to do, unless man simply be robotized and become a slave to the machine. At this very point, and this is an undetermined question in the destiny of mankind, at this point, Christians and the resources of the Christian church must be committed to the processes of dialogue and decision-making which bear upon the future of mankind. Their pictures of true humanity and true community are, after all, or should be, seen through the eschatological prismatic of the person of Jesus and the proleptic community of the New Age, the Apostolic Church. The missionary task in the world today, in the technological culture, is to make these images, the image of Christ and his church, driving and alluring forces in universal history. Karl Rahner has written, it is sadly perhaps possible to show that the Christians of this day and age occupy themselves far too little with the programming of man's future in this world, as if this did not present any problem or could safely be left to the non-Christian. Modern technology is only one of the fronts on which man meets the challenge of the future. Let's look through several others very briefly. There is a psychology of hope. Carl Menninger has been called an apostle of hope. A psychology of hope has emerged to awaken in man's imagination a lively interest in the future. From a psychoanalytic point of view, hope is at the heart of a human being, and as Carl Menninger says, an indispensable ingredient of personal therapy. Hope is a sense of the possible. It tries to transcend the present moment. It looks to the world expecting a helpful response. Without hope, a person could not put one foot in front of the other. Hope looks to the next step. The concomitant of hope is the belief that one is going somewhere, that there is a goal worth striving for. Otherwise, we are sick. We move into the future, therefore, to the degree that we have hope. The voice of hope says there is a way out. Hopelessness says, as darkness says, no exit. Hope exists within a constant, a pure light of gold that looks out upon the horizon of the future. As there is a psychology of hope, there is also a biology of hope today. Now, this has been known for a long time. Thomas Aquinas already ascribed the germ of hope, even to animals, since they are moved by natural instinct to direct their actions towards the future. The thinker who has carried out this idea most impressively in modern times is, of course, Father Tayal de Chardin. Father Tayal saw hope as the essential impulse in keeping life moving onward and upward. Hope is a faith in the future. The only belief in God that Pius could see that modern man could still accept was one which embraced faith in the future of the world. But Pius was a scientist by profession, a paleontologist, a student of pastoralism. He believed he could read the patterns of the future in the evidences of the past. He wrote, "The study of the past has revealed to me the structure of the future." Taya loved the future more than the past, though a student of the past. He wrote, "The world is only interesting if you look at its future." His ideal of man was homo progressivus, the man to whom the terrestrial future matters even more than the present. He expressed himself as repelled by any attitude explicitly or implicitly attributing an absolute value, which he found especially in his own, among his own fellow Roman Catholics at that time, an absolute value to the backward glance. Our nostalgia for the snows of yesterday in the Christian church is morbid, he wrote. What has been has now no intrinsic interest. Forward, en avant. The only thing worth the trouble of finding is what has never yet existed. The only task worthy of our efforts is to construct the future. End of quote. Christian theology has not yet taken the full measure of Hayyav's importance for its own work. The first word, however, must be a positive one. Here was a man of hope, a modern man, a religious man, a scientist, inspiring in his contemporaries a confidence in the future, at a time when it was, as he said, as many of his intellectual cohorts were existentialists, that good form to deride or mistrust anything that looks like faith in the future of man. But there is an ambiguity in Hayyav's idea of the future, which I think presents a challenge to theology. Hayyav's basic idea of the future was teleological, not eschatological. And his main access to the future was scientific extrapolation, or at last, at least, so he thought. Thus, by studying the past, he believed that as a scientist it was possible, although always somewhat risky, to extend the curve beyond the fact, that is to say, as he said, to extrapolate the future from the past to the present. The traceable evolutionary swing upwards from inorganic to organic, from pre-human to human, forms may be extended, therefore, to ultra-human forms that lie in the future. Rightly understood, Hayyav said, the theory of evolution offers us a lesson of hope. We have to ask, without entering into an argument with Hayyav, is this really the supporting basis of Christian hope? And the hope for the world? For each man living now, especially when Hayyav himself foresaw a billion centuries of life that, according to the astronomers, still await humanity. Can we wait a billion years? Hayyav thought of movements in the universe, cosmogenesis, biogenesis, anthropogenesis, in terms of the attracting power of the future. Evolution advances not so much from a push from within, but by some kind of pull from ahead, from the omega point. This omega point is the Dieu en avant, a God ahead of us, the future goal of the world and mankind. In speaking like this, Father Hayyav conceived some symbols which may be in the future of value to Christian theologians seeking correlation with our own culture. Often, however, and this is a preliminary judgment on my part, this Dieu en avant in Hayyav's writing resembles the prime mover unmoved of classical metaphysics and lacks the freedom and spontaneity of the God of Israel in relation to the world and human history. So we ask, is a teleological conception of the future an adequate translation of the eschatological horizon of the future within which the self-revelation of God occurs? Teleology is a form of secular futurology that is not dead, despite many attempts to ban it. In Hayyav, it operates as a unifying model in which Christian eschatology is biologized and biology is eschatologized. Teleology may be seen as secularized eschatology. this synthesis, this refusal to have two masters, accounts both for the mysterious attraction of Tao's thought in our time and for the fact that many scientists question the science and theologians the theology that results. Finally, our last point, the hermeneutics of horizon. The hermeneutical framework of our inquiry is the horizon of the future. According to one of the dictionary meanings, a horizon is the place where the sky meets the earth. In the popular mind, it often conjures up images of a wild blue yonder. Obviously, neither of these meanings is very helpful. However, in phenomenological and hermeneutical philosophy today, horizon is a field of vision which includes two sides, one subjective, the other objective. The horizon of the viewer is his subjective standpoint, how he looks out upon the world. The objective pole is the wide range of what comes into view, the outer limit within which anything that exists has its place and meaning. Obviously, a horizon is thus not to be thought of as merely subjective or objective, but involves a dynamic situation in which the horizon of the subject attempts to expand continually to overtake the horizon of all that is not yet known. Thus, a horizon is not a closed and fixed situation, neither on the subjective side nor on the objective side. The concept of horizon is appropriate to the theology of history, which asks about the meaning of Jesus Christ as a past historical event, as an occurrence within a particular historical horizon, the meaning of that event within that horizon for each subsequent historical situation which is bounded by its own limitations. What is the meaning of Jesus Christ as an historical occurrence for the present, for the future? The Christ event is an occurrence within the horizon of a particular historical situation. And that situation is different from every other historical situation. Now, the hermeneutical task is to understand this event again and again within a new historical situation like our own, without doing violence to the particular character of the horizon within which he stands. The subjective pole of the horizon of our inquiry, I said the subjective pole is where the viewer stands, his outlook. The subjective pole of the horizon of our inquiry is characterized by hope, which is disclosed through phenomenology as a structural element of human existence. In hope, man seeks to inquire beyond himself toward that which is not yet. Man is a questioning being who seeks to surpass himself, to break new ground, to reach toward new frontiers. He struggles to go beyond every existing situation, to find an exit, and to push out the boundaries of any world that closes in upon him. Hope is a horizon of one who asks questions. For the questioning process cannot continue indefinitely without the hope of reaching answers. Now, in modern hermeneutics, we have to introduce the names of some important figures, Bultmann. Bultmann will be remembered in the history of hermeneutics, therefore is a new stimulus for method in systematic theology, for underscoring the existential structure of man as one who questions. Man is one who asks questions because he is a question to himself. He is radically questionable, and therefore he questions. This is why he carries on historical research. Not because he enjoys doing that so much, but he bothers to dig into ancient manuscripts in order to probe the meaning of his own existence. Now, the way he puts a question to a text is conditioned by the horizon of his own existential situation, his Fragestellung. For Buchmann, one brings to the biblical text the question concerning human existence. We accept this. We accept it into our concept of horizon as an indispensable element. We begin with Buchmann. The question arises, however, whether we want to end there. That is to say, whether Buchmann's understanding exhausts our contemporary horizon. In ordinary language, we speak of a person's horizon. Are they narrow? Are they broad enough? If someone is bound to prejudices, which let him see only what lies in front of his own nose, we say of a person like that, he needs to expand his horizon. For the hermeneutical task, it is important that the interpreter's horizon be broadened to the point that he can appreciate the horizon of the text within which its own complex of questions and answers once arose. This does not mean that the interpreter ceases to have his own horizon. He does not sacrifice his horizon to the horizon of the Bible. He does not repeat the Bible. He does not imitate the Bible. He does not try to be a Jew of the first century. He does not sacrifice his own horizon, for without it he could see nothing at all. Nothing worth seeing. It does mean, however, that the interpreter's horizon remains flexible, supple, and open to change. In going to the biblical text, for example, it is not enough to see only what appears within the fixed horizon of one starting point. Then, of course, there's no point going to a biblical text or any historical text. In the hermeneutical process, one's initial horizon, one's starting point, must be made vulnerable, open to criticism. From the questions and answers that stand within an alien horizon, and so one must keep one's own horizon ready for widening. If Boltzmann's statement is correct, that we do approach the biblical text with a prior interest, for self-centeredness, with a prior interest of finding out what they say concerning the question of human existence, is this starting point an exhaustive starting point? Is it adequate to the description of the horizon of modern man? Does this existential starting point, we ask, offer a wide enough horizon to coincide with or overlap the horizon of the biblical text? Or does it not force some important things to drop out of sight? May not one's existential horizon be broadened, be challenged, to take in a wider range of subject matter than appears at first sight? And so it seems to us, and it's precisely because of this that we have not been able to remain with Bultmann's hermeneutic proposal. The horizon of the biblical text does include questions and answers concerning human existence, but it does much more than that. For the horizon of man's self-understanding, as the biblical authors understand it, is enfolded within the wider horizon of their understanding of God and his actions, not just within the privacy of my own experience, not just between me and another person in the I-thou relation, but his actions in the world of history, in the world of nations, in the political arena. Even as a starting point, however, The existentialist horizon of inquiry is far too narrow. Within the horizon of hope, the question of self-understanding or of authentic existence is intertwined inextricably, as I think we have to learn from the social philosophers, is inextricably intertwined with the question of social and communal well-being, social and communal fulfillment, and even cosmic fulfillment. So what I'm saying, that the existentialist horizon, its starting point, is inadequate because it does not overlap, it does not overtake the horizon of the biblical complex of questions and answers, but as a starting point, it is not even adequate because it does not exhaust the horizon of man, of modern man, as a creature who hopes. For one does not hope merely for oneself. One's longing for healing, for wholeness, embraces the longing for the healing of the community, for the world of which one is a part. What good does it do to be healed and then be sent back into a sick world? One longs for the healing and the wholeness of the world within which one lives. The utopias of mankind teach us that. Yesterday's utopias, today's utopias, provide the evidence that the scope of hope expressed in this literature is seldom restricted to the existentialist narrowing of the horizon to include only possibilities of individual human existence. Above all, the biblical symbol of the kingdom of God, about which there is almost complete silence along the whole existentialist track from Bultmann through Abelling, the biblical symbol of the kingdom of God will never be reducible to an individualistic horizon of interest. The next big name is Paul Tillich. The logic of question and answer in the hermeneutical situation was elevated by Paul Tillich into the very structure of theological method, the method of correlation. We accept that. We stand with Bultmann, we stand with Tillich, so far as they have illuminated elements in the hermeneutical situation. There is no fundamental indifference in principle between Tillich and Bultmann at this point. Their real differences arose because Tillich's range of questions was so much broader than Bultmann's. Though Tillich was frequently called an existentialist theologian in the popular press in America and introduced at campuses and so on that way, any reading of his systematic theology will disclose that the rational, ontological, vitalistic, and historical foundations of his theological questions extended far, far, far beyond existentialism. Yet Tillich, as much as Bultmann, stressed that the answer you receive is shaped by the question you put to the biblical text and to the traditional sources of the Christian faith. The interpreter also brings into his inquiry, as he looks into the text of tradition, his ultimate concern, that is, his religious question. He stands within a hermeneutic circle, one dimension of which is a religious question of man. The dialectic of question and answer, as carried out by Paul Tillich, in my view, is the perennial task of any theology at all worth its salt. For the question is man himself, in his correlation with the world, and the answer is given through the charisma of the kingdom of God. The apologetic demands on Tillich's systematic theology were too heavy, however, to allow the full force of the hermeneutical problem to appear. And here I state the reason why, finally, I had to make a break with this kind of hermeneutic proposal. Tillich's system bridged the gulf between the eternal message and the temporal situation, as this was ridden with doubt and despair. The hermeneutic gulf created by the historical problem was never confronted head-on by Paul Tillich. The historical problem in hermeneutics is that the horizon of the first century situation becomes ever more distant from our present situation as time goes on. To be sure, Tillich's problem, the problem of the eternal and the temporal, the vertical problem in hermeneutics runs through every situation. But it ought not overshadow the problem of the historical distance between the then of the biblical text and the now of our present horizon of understanding. Modern man is alienated not only from the ground of being, as in Tillich's theology. Modern man is alienated also from the horizon of the historical situation within which the biblical authors wrote. The major new movement in modern theology has been concerned to bridge over the distance between these horizons of understanding. The horizon of understanding in primitive Christianity, the horizon of understanding of modern man. First we had Bultmann's demythologizing, then the post-Bultmannian new quest of the historical Jesus, thirdly, the new hermeneutic of Abeling and Fuchs, and then fourthly, the current secular or non-religious interpretation of biblical concepts. These are all hermeneutic proposals. Four in a row in one decade to keep you busy. Whatever one may think of them as solutions to the historical gulf between the biblical text and the present situation, in struggling with the problem, they have radicalized it and have made all easy solutions quite impossible from here on in. Apologetic interests must not be permitted to rush in too quickly to carry answers from the past into the framework of the present situation. What is it, then, that makes the answers in the past really relevant to questions that are being asked in the present? By what kind of logic can you assume that answers that were given once upon a time are adequate to the dimensions of the human problem today? How is it possible to release them, those answers which are confined within the horizon of their own historical situation, how is it possible to release them from those limits to meet the needs of a totally different time and place? This is a historical dimension of the problem which has never left us alone since the beginning of the 18th century. Unfortunately, Tillich's attempt to solve the hermeneutic problem blurred over this historical dimension of the hermeneutic problem, partly because of his apologetic fragestellung, partly and most deeply because Tillich's ontological categories were overwhelmed by the ahistorical being of Parmenides and the ahistorical logos of the Stoics. Hermeneutic problem, as the gulf between horizons, the horizon of the biblical text and the horizon of the modern interpreter, has received its most careful philosophical analysis by H.G. Gadamer. On the basis of Gadamer's analysis, philosopher at Heidelberg, but with an even keener grasp of this gulf, so far as it bears upon Christian existence, Wolfhard Pannenberg has pointed the way, in my opinion, to merge the horizon, to overbridge the distance between the horizon of the biblical text and the horizon of the modern situation. The first requirement is to see that there is a hiatus between the past text and the present interpreter. The second requirement is to build a hermeneutical found the particularity of both the horizon of primitive Christianity and the horizon of the present situation. To do this, it is necessary to penetrate historically to what the text reports, and to discover the central occurrences and their meaning within the horizon of their own time of origin. We must be historians. Otherwise, the theologian may very well fasten on to quite peripheral or superficial matters. They're there in the biblical text, but they are peripheral and marginal. They're just the things which happen to be most easily amenable to the horizon of the investigator. Then I go down the cafeteria line of those 66 books, pick and choose just what I see, what pleases me. This leads to factual and false contemporization, which is a classic trademark of liberalism. Orthodoxy, biblicism, and fundamentalism, however you want to define these terms, and I'm running out of breath, are characterized by the attempt to merge the horizons by submerging the particularities of the present, the richness, the gifts of the present time. They are the gifts of God in the present time, to submerge them, to drown them into the strange but supposedly sacred traditions of the past. The zeal of orthodoxy, biblicism, and fundamentalism is the sacrifice of the past in order to come into congruity with some past, to sacrifice the present and story in order to make it congruent with some past. Usually, this is some sacred past, some sacred tradition. These sacred traditions are equated with some past apprehension of the past. The 5th century, the 13th century, the 16th century, or the 19th century. What is new and valid in the present is reduced or even denied, violated, in the interest of keeping the past intact. This, in my view, is the primal sin of the Church. The refusal to listen to the Spirit and to turn the back on the expectation of the coming of God's kingdom. Ironically, the traditionalist stance, on the surface so different, is exactly like the liberalist stance, the liberalist type of radicalism, because both operate with rigid horizons. The distinctive claims of the subject matter, its particular content within its own horizon, are not permitted to break through as something new, calling for a revision of old horizons. If one expects to learn something new from history, the most objective and historically appropriate attitude is to be open to a new horizon, a horizon not yet one's own. The horizon can be merged only when the total context of history within which both horizons move is projected. The meaning of a past event can be understood only contextually, never as an isolated datum. I suppose we all agree with that. This immediate context, in turn, can be understood only within a still broader context, where the context itself and the context of a single historical event is itself a historical event and needs to be understood in relation to a still broader context. The more inclusive context makes possible a more adequate understanding. In this way, the question of universal history must ultimately arise. In my view, Pannenberg is right, must ultimately arise in the course of historical interpretation. that immediate horizon to the horizon of each succeeding epoch until it is connected with the horizon of the present age. This idea of universal history brings Tannenberg in the direction of Hegel's universal philosophy or philosophy of universal history. Tannenberg, however, purges Hegel's idea of its failure to acknowledge, and these are in part the revisions of Hegel's dream of universal history, one, the finitude of human existence or experience. Secondly, the uniqueness of the individual. And thirdly, the openness to the future. If these Hegelian errors are avoided, a contemporary systematic theology of history, beginning with eschatology, will be able to fuse the horizon. And in a philosophical sense, that is in terms of where philosophy will stack up today, we will overcome that dualism which we referred to last night when we talked about the split between subjectivity and objectification that we've inherited from Kant. This dualism can be overcome by way of a new affirmation of Hegel's fundamental understanding. The future horizon of history is intrinsic to the interpretation of history. The full meaning of the present is not disclosed by its connection with the past, and the meaning of the past cannot be given by the past. The meaning of the past and the present is determined by their future. Boltzmann hit upon this idea at one time, but failed to follow it through to its ultimate conclusion. As a student of history, Boltzmann once wrote, "But what these events," he was wrestling now with the interpretation of certain biblical data, "but what these events that can thus be dated mean as historical events cannot be definitively fixed. Hence, one must say that a historical event is always first knowable for what it is, precisely as a historical event in the future. We could not know the historical Jesus in the days of his flesh, but only in the future do we get a disclosure of the meaning of the historical Jesus." It's this kind of thing. And therefore, one can also say that the future of a historical event belongs to that event. Then Boltzmann added, "It holds good that what a historical event means always first becomes clear in the future. It can definitely disclose itself only when history has come to an end." Only when history has come to an end. In short, the meaning of history, the question of the meaning of history as a totality, is linked to the horizon of the future. We simply have to say that to look at historical data, we do not get the answer to the question of the meaning of those data. The horizon of the past can be fused with the horizon of the present only through their common orientation upon the horizon of the future end of history. That is why the first Christian thought that in Jesus Christ, when they saw in him the inbreaking of the eschatological event, they saw in him the key, the clue to the interpretation of world history. Thus, any serious wrestling with a hermeneutical problem today opens up the question of a possible eschatological interpretation of history. Of a possible eschatological interpretation. Eschatology is anticipated through the quest for the meaning of history. I say it's anticipated, it's not given through the study of history, it's anticipated as a question. And so we make this wager. Is it more than a happy coincidence? Is it just a happy coincidence that the historical study of the earliest Christian sources today has of itself discovered the eschatological character of the message of Jesus and of the apostolic charisma? Eschatology was in the core of Jesus' preaching of the kingdom of God. Eschatology is needed for an understanding of the meaning of history. His was a message for the world and its future. Systematic theology.
theology has never yet taken seriously the dimension of the future in this method for its own work, but has shunted it aside by altering the meaning and structure of eschatology. The bridge of the two horizons is possible only within the horizon of the future. As a questioning being, man is oriented in hope towards the future. Early Christianity proclaimed the eschatological message of the future as the future of God, as the very being of God. The future is essential to the very being of God. It's the mode of his very being. And proclaimed the coming of his kingdom in Christ as the goal of man's hope. Starting then with the horizon of our present situation, we are confronted by what at first glance seems to be nothing but the alien horizon of biblical apocalypticism. However, as I tried to argue last night and tonight, the deeper one delves into the heart of biblical eschatology, the more it opens up the horizon of the future and makes the Christian community a future-oriented community. Future of the individual, the future of mankind, the future of the cosmos, and thus makes the real correlation possible with the anticipatory thrust for the future that runs throughout nature and history, individuals and society. Well, I think I better stop.
The Christian gospel can expect to get a hearing in modern culture only if it explores the revolutionary potential of the horizon of the future that is given in and with the advent of God in Jesus of Nazareth. The Christian gospel can expect to get a hearing in modern culture only if it has some important news to bring about our human future. If it is concerned about the world tomorrow, if the Christian message has interesting things to say about the past, but has nothing important to say concerning man and the building of his future, Christianity is properly dismissed as deleterious, as irrelevant. Christianity must learn again, then, to take up the burdens of mankind for a better future, for a new future. Christianity is a revolutionary movement in history, or it is the movement of the Antichrist. There is a sting in the 11th and last of Marx's theses on Feuerbach, and what he says of philosophers could be said of theologians. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. Ernst Bloch, who is a Marxist philosopher in Tübingen, has said that whatever is cannot be true. Whatever is there to be changed from the power of the advancing future. Talk about changing the world implies that we assume responsibility for the future. It is the responsibility of Christian hope. We have had creative theology in the modern era, but unfortunately, this creative theology has rapidly become sterile because it has struck up alliances with philosophies which black out the vision of the future and settled for an easy adjustment with the status quo. In recent times, two great attractions to theology have been existentialism and language analysis in its post-positivistic version. First, existentialism. Existentialism is a philosophy of the self. It seeks salvation in the inner freedom of man through Entweltlichung, that is, through detachment from the world. Existentialism is eschatological. Yes, it
anticipate the future. The future is death. Death rolls its dark shadows back upon the inner self, evoking despair, anxiety, fear, what else? Pointlessness, meaninglessness. There the self exists in the world. The world of other selves, of politics, of society, economics, there is the world, but there is nothing in it. Nothing in the world to confirm the outreach of the self for fulfillment. So the self is hurled back upon its own inner resources, only to gaze into the abyss of its own nothingness. There is no basis for hope, and the future means annihilation. Christian theology has tried to meet this desperate situation, saying, the existentialists are right, that's just the way things are. The existentialists have the right analysis of the human predicament, the right reading of the world reality. We Christians, we come along and we put Christ into the situation as an outside help, or the charisma, or the word of God as a rescue agent. Ever since Immanuel Kant, theology has been placed in the dilemma of a split reality that is mirrored in existentialism. There is the objective world outside. That is the objectified field of modern science, which investigates nature and history as closed systems of cause and effect. Some theologians, and unfortunately many scientists too, continue to look upon the world as a fixed cosmos, running like an electric clock according to set laws. But Kant assured us that's not all there is to it. There is a subjective realm of the self, the interior realm of moral means and ends, of freedom, decision, the realm of practical reason, of obedience and responsibility, of duty. Theology saw a new opening for itself, for what it meant by the word God, what it meant by the gospel, in the transphenomenal dimension of subjectivity. Theology had the outside world close to it, and so it went inside. Theology became interiorized piety. Theology, since Kierkegaard, became personalistic and existentialistic. The gospel was contracted to a message of individual salvation. This theology of existence, pietistic in its very origin, became isolated from society on the ground of the Lutheran Two Kingdom doctrine. Isolated from the world, isolated from the course of history, the inner changes called for in man to attain authentic selfhood had no effect on the world, on society, on politics, on the future of the world. Jaspers expresses the mood perfectly of his time when he speaks of the futility of inquiries concerning the future. Theology, which became locked in an embrace with existentialism, folded the biblical eschatological horizon of the future of the world as history into the existentialist personalistic horizon of futurity as a predicate of what he called the cyclicite, the historicity of existence. That is to say, the promises of the gospel which have a worldwide scope, a cosmic eschatology, were lavished on the individual as therapy for the soul's sickness unto death. Existentialism and theology's alliance with it must be seen as a retreat into the self, away from the objective world outside ruled by the inexorable laws of causality. Existentialism did not question that the world was just such a mechanism of determined facts and factors. Existentialism presupposed it, but only sought refuge from it in the interiority of the self. The solitary self did not hope to change the tyranny of scientific positivism and logical empiricism.
but only to escape into an internal realm of personal freedom and meaning in the dimension of the I-thou. The Christian claims with respect to divine revelation and historical salvation that all to be made good within the dimension of subjectivity. The truth of this is in no wise diminished by a loud stress on the radical objectivity or subjecthood of God as the one who in his total otherness breaks in from the outside into the incommensurable sphere of humanity. For that is nothing more than a subjective claim, which moreover declares itself free of any responsibility to be tested in face of competing criteria and claims to truth. Christian theology was satisfied to become isolated, provided it could count on non-interference from other disciplines. You leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. Theology's answer to a positivism of science was a positivism of its own, what Dietrich Bonhoeffer and accusing Karl Barth called Offenbarungspositivismus, as a positivism of revelation. For a while it appeared they could exist, coexist, even in the same heart and mind. Moltmann's judgment is apropos. He says, hence the result is, as for Kierkegaard, the alliance of a theoretic atheism and a believing heart. Bonhoeffer raised a protest against Barth's positivistic doctrine of revelation and provoked theology to seek a secular translation of the gospel. Bonhoeffer himself, however, did not offer a positive clue as to what might be meant by a non-religious interpretation of biblical concepts. What system of categories, what words or concepts or symbols would pass for being secular? Bonhoeffer did not look with favor on Bultmann's existentialist demythologizing, nor on Tillich's mystical ontologizing, nor on Barth's rechristenation of traditional dogmatic concepts. The attempt has been made since Bonhoeffer to turn Bonhoeffer's protest into a program and to find secular equivalents of the gospel free of its traditionally religious framework. And the death of God theology, to a large extent, at least in the case of Paul Van Buren and William Hamilton, is the attempt to make a program out of Bonhoeffer's protest. So we turn to another front on which theology has tried to establish a creative relationship with philosophy. The later work of Ludwig Wittgenstein in his philosophical investigations is currently being pushed as a promising philosophical ally for theology. I've just returned from a year in Oxford. I can say that this seems to be the attraction on the horizon for Anglo-Saxon theologians. This is called the philosophy of ordinary language analysis. It has the unquestionable merit of being able to claim contemporary relevance, for after all, was it not hacked from the incubator of scientific positivism? Wittgenstein's first important work, Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, still stands as a major tract of positivism. If theology can succeed in making sense for itself within the framework of the philosophical movement that runs from the Tractatus, the early Wittgenstein, through the investigations, the later Wittgenstein, and beyond, it will have scored a victory. First, theology will have taken itself out of its solitary confinement. And secondly, it will have found for itself a distinguished partner in the modern world of secular thought. And this is what many theologians are trying to do. And therefore, they look to Wittgensteinian or post-Wittgensteinian language analysis philosophy. Ordinary language philosophy can help theology to analyze the logic of its own linguistic heritage. So far, however, the world of language analysis has had a smothering effect on theology. I do not say it has to have that. I simply make it as an empirical judgment, right or wrong,
that language analysis philosophy has had a smothering effect on theology. Rather than acting as midwife, it has served more as abortionist, bringing the baby out dead. Most theologians who have agreed to play by the rules of this linguistical game have behaved very badly, even when they have played brilliantly. It can be a boring game for theology to play, unless it turns to the analysis of extraordinary language, the visionary language of hope, the utopian language of revolutionaries, the Christian language of the future, the strange images of dreams, the imaginative figures of poetry. So far, this language, this futurist language, which transgresses against the ordinary world of words and things, has aroused little interest among the language analysts. They have little passion for the future. They have not found the philosophical incentive to delve into language that fastens on to the future, that goads the philosopher to criticize the actual present in light of his anticipations. So there has been a kind of alliance between a realized eschatology and this philosophy of ordinary language. As one philosopher has aptly charged, language analysis philosophy is a nursery for leaving the world exactly as it is. And so is realized eschatology, such a nursery. Too many theologians who have attended this nursery school use their linguistical and logical skills to justify the ordinary language of the Christian tradition, sometimes in the most hollow phrases of natural theology and the most static utterances of the Bible or the Creed. And so it is not uncommon for British theologians to use the analysis of language method of language philosophy to return them to the Christology of Athanasius, and there they remain. The philosophy of language analysis in its present mood can easily serve to confirm the theologian in the convictions he already has, leaving everything as it is, or to offer him an exit from the Christian faith with no difference to his philosophy. Examples could be given. The point, of course, is not to be made ad hominem, but to put a question to theologians who profess the metaphysical neutrality of ordinary language philosophy. The philosophers will get around to asking themselves the same question, as they usually do. The question is the one to which Herbert Marcuse devoted a chapter entitled The Triumph of Positive Thinking, One-Dimensional Philosophy, in his book, One-Dimensional Man. In a way, Marcuse's book is a diatribe against Deutero-Wittgenstein, against the later Wittgenstein. And it is this Wittgensteinian philosophy which some theologians are hailing as though it were a revelation of providence. Marcuse's thesis runs something like this. Language analysis has not shed the positivistic attitude toward reality. Positivism is a passive acceptance of reality as it is, the given frame of reference, the ordinary use of language, the common modes of behavior. The great enemy is a revolutionary philosophy of change whose concepts are in transcendent tension with, even in contradiction to, the established world of speech and action. Analytic philosophy is an invention which suits the comfortable life of the Oxford Don, who takes the world as it is and can easily afford to do so. Linguistic analysis has an intrinsically ideological character. Its methods are self-effacing and humble before the established reality. It is a therapy to relieve the cramps of the mind induced by the great metaphysical questions about ultimate truth and ultimate reality. Thus it removes the only possible resources from which to contradict and to violate the established universe of discourse.
the man on the street with his ordinary language, plain old Joe Doe, so full of common sense, yields the raw material for the analyst's language game. Marcuse, like many others, calls attention to how trivial the language under analysis can be. As he says, blown up atoms of language, silly scraps of speech that sound like baby talk, such as, "This looks to me now like a man eating poppy." He saw a robin. I had a hat. The reader of this philosophy and of the theology created after its image becomes bored at receiving so damn much clarity on such trivial subjects. Marcuse offers many examples, such as how much skill and space Wittgenstein in the theological investigation spent in analyzing the assertion, "My broom is in the corner." A systematic theology of the future must, of course, be interested in the analysis of language. Only the language is not very ordinary. But more important than that, the aim of the analysis is revolutionary. The language is taken from the storehouse of promise, prophecy, apocalypse, from the prospects of hope and vision of utopians, futurists, and revolutionaries. Not that it need ignore the forms of language that correspond to the empirical facts of perception, to the existing state of things. But the goal of analysis is not simply clarity, to get clear and distinct ideas, or to create models of reality to describe what already has been or already is. Rather, the aim of analysis is to know what is, in order to change it, to create new language, to fit new reality, that new history brings in as the present reality is transgressed from the pressures and power of the future upon it. Whatever is cannot be true. The one who said, "Nothing new under the sun" was not a wise man, but he was suffering from an optical illusion. Language has a proleptic structure, anticipating the truth of reality that is not yet, that is hoped for, perhaps something to be prayed for. We pray, "Thy kingdom come," because it has not yet fully come, something to be awaited. Theology should welcome the new logical and linguistic means of analysis, of course, while challenging, however, all the neo-positivistic assumptions about language and reality in analytic philosophy. Whatever Wittgenstein might have meant in saying that, and of course, this is why there are theologians who like this late Wittgensteinian philosophy. Wittgenstein said that philosophy leaves everything as it is. And he said, "Every sentence in our language is in order as it is." I submit the face value of such statements can give the theologian false comfort and make him complacent within his own given tradition. For when the theologian transposes, he says, "Everything given in the tradition is okay as it is. We only need to analyze, to understand, to get clear and distinct ideas of what has been, of what already is. As if this ordinary world and our ordinary language are all we want them to be. As if they have arrived History is finished. Language is complete. We have only to discern, to think clear and distinct ideas. What kind of a world does Wittgenstein imagine when he avers the problems are solved, he says, not by giving new information, but by arranging what we have always known? Why do theologians rejoice when philosophy announces philosophy may in no way interfere with the actual use of language? It is understandable, of course, that theology, which has been suffering from an inferiority complex in the face of the positivistic spirit of the age, it is understandable that theology would breathe slightly more easily in partnership with a philosophy which does not prohibit a priori the use of religious language, which does not call it meaningless. But underlying this new tolerance in language philosophy is the one-dimensional thinking which infects a philosophy or a theology whose implicit ideology is satisfaction with a ready-made world of the establishment, when that ready-made world is the established church with its established doctrines, its traditional cants and cults and canons, its traditional liturgies, its traditional structures. Theology is acting ideologically when it seeks out an alliance with this kind of a philosophy. Well, then this philosophy helps the established theology to keep things just the way they are. Modern theology, through its encounter with existentialism on the one side and positivism on the other, must press on to a conception of reality as a whole that overcomes the split between subjectivity and objectification which has been inherited since Immanuel Kant. The two sides of this split universe can be overbridged only in a fluid conception of reality as history opening toward the future, the horizon of which is illuminated by the Christ event. It would be fatal for theology to imagine that it could survive by retreating into the sphere of subjectivity or by accommodating itself to the objectified world of words and things. The eschatological message of the Christian faith is concerned not merely with the private things of the soul, but with the public realities of the world and its future. The individual does not have a history of his own. The idea of the individual is an abstraction. Does not have a history of his own apart from the world. His life does not have a meaning of its own at odds with the world. He has a history and a meaning with a history and the meaning of all creatures, of all creations, allen Kreaturen, Luther said in the Small Catechism. The truth and the meaning of his history and the world's history are revealed only at the end when God shall be all in all. But already now, as Christians know and believe, that end has appeared, has arrived in a preliminary way, as the first fruit, not as the last fruit, as the first fruit, the Bible says. This is the initial inbreaking of the end in the history of Jesus Christ. And this is why all Christian theology may be said to be a messianic interpretation of history. This is why Christians should think of themselves as children on the way, en route, with a passion for the future of reality, not yet seen. This by itself places Christians in tension with any mode of thinking, however dogmatically correct or pragmatically useful, any mode of thinking which takes this world as it is. The status quo is not what it is meant to be, no matter how good it seems, and it doesn't seem so good right now. The world is there to be changed. Christians pray, "Thy kingdom come," every day, many times a day, because their imaginations are filled with visions of new things, of new reality, of things which have not yet happened. In the present, we Christians may work to invalidate and to subvert the fact We are subversive. We are revolutionary. So that facts might become fine events beckoning the future of new realities struggling to be born in the present. The present world is loved for what it might become, not for what it is, for the sake of its future in the kingdom of God. Thank you.